I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, part two of our examination of the late New York Times journalist Neil Sheehan, who passed away on January 7th, 2021. The coverage of the Capitol riots on January 6th in many ways overshadowed Sheehan's passing. And yet, an article was published by the New York Times that claims to reveal the truth about Neil Sheehan's involvement in the saga of the Pentagon Papers, a secret study that revealed a great deal about the Vietnam War that many Americans were in the dark about before whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg sought to relay the papers to the American public, even at the expense of himself. The New York Times article, written by Jenny Scott, was entitled, "Now It Can Be Told: How Neil Sheehan Got the Pentagon Papers," and features an account of the Pentagon Papers saga from Sheehan in 2015 that he did not want published until his passing. In this telling of the Pentagon Papers saga, Sheehan comes off as the true hero, while whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg is portrayed as a fearful neurotic who made foolish mistakes in his attempts to alert the public of the revelations found in the Pentagon Papers. Jim Noricus, however, argues that there are major problems with the New York Times article, and as such, FAIR has published an action alert entitled, "What Can Now Be Told by the New York Times About the Pentagon Papers Isn't Actually True." Jim joins us on this edition of the program to fire back at the article released by the New York Times, as well as to discuss the problems inherent to valorizing the heroism of journalists while downplaying the courage and bravery of whistleblowers like Daniel Ellsberg. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. Welcome to Parallax Views. Jim Noricus of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
So I want to cover this action alert that FAIR released, "What Can Now Be Told by NYT About Pentagon Papers Isn't Actually True," from January 14th. But first, since this is your first time on the show, could you tell my listeners a little bit about FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting?
Well, we're a Media Watch group. We've been around since 1986. And it's our job to keep an eye on what the corporate media is up to, and give people some tools to help critically read the information that they get to better understand what's going on.
So in regards to this action alert, maybe we should just first go over who was Neil Sheehan?
Neil Sheehan was a reporter for the New York Times, famously covered the Vietnam War for them, and was one of the reporters who was involved in getting out the Pentagon Papers, which were a secret history of the Vietnam War put together by the Pentagon and snuck out of the Pentagon by Daniel Ellsberg, an analyst, and published by the New York Times, and it really did a lot to expose the deception. behind the Vietnam War and made it clear that the government had been lying to the public about the war for many, many years.
It was a massive bombshell of a revelation, ultimately.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we live in a post-Pentagon Papers era now, so you have to put yourself back in the mindset of people who, a lot of people thought that the government didn't lie to them, you know, which I think you'd be sort of hard-pressed to find someone who believed that today. I think that the Pentagon Papers did a lot to wake people up about the fact that the government will, you know, be saying one thing and then and admitting to themselves inside that something very different is true.
Now, in regards to Neil Sheehan, he just passed away on January 7th. It may have gone under some folks' radar due to the Capitol Hill riots, the insurrection on Capitol Hill. But a new article has come out on the Times. Now it can be told how Neil Sheehan got the Pentagon Papers. What was this article about, and why did Fair push back on it?
Well, this is a an article that came out. It was written by the person who wrote Neil Sheehan's obituary. And your listeners may be aware that obituaries are usually written in advance. They're not written. You don't start writing them when the person dies. You write them ahead of time so that when they die, you can publish it. And this person was writing an obituary of Neil Sheehan and found that there wasn't much known about how, you know, probably the most famous story that he had done actually came out. The you know, how did he get the Pentagon Papers?
This is the reporter Janie Scott, right? And this was in 2015. Mm-hmm.
And so she wrote to Neil Sheehan, who had not talked much about how he had gotten the papers, and he invited her to hear his story, and under the condition that it only be published after his death. And so she wrote it all down and kept it for 6 years, and her obituary was published, and alongside of it was this longer piece talking about, you know, what was billed as the true story of the Pentagon Papers. The reason that Fair did an action alert on this is that the story that Sheehan tells is actually pretty dubious. And the way that Scott frames it is quite clearly wrong. You know, it's self-contradictory. And the key line early on, and this is sort of like what they call the nut graph in journalism, the graph that explains, you know, here's why this story is important. Here's what's going on. And she wrote, "Contrary to what is generally believed, Mr. Ellsberg never gave the papers to the Times," Mr. Sheehan emphatically said. Mr. Ellsberg told Mr. Sheehan that he could read them, but not make copies. This is she goes on. "So Mr. Sheehan smuggled the papers out of the apartment in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Mr. Ellsberg had stashed them. Then he copied them illicitly, just as Mr. Ellsberg had done, and took them to the Times." You know, if true, this would be a big deal. That Daniel Ellsberg, who is, you know, one of America's most famous whistleblowers, according to this story, never actually gave the papers that he's famous for giving to the press to the press. He hung on to them, and according to this story, an intrepid reporter was the one who took them from his apartment and copied them and published them. So Sheehan is like the hero of this story.
And he also is framing Ellsberg as merely a fearful neurotic that makes foolish mistakes. Is that correct?
Yeah. Ellsberg comes off very poorly in Sheehan's version of the story, as this this person who's kind of scared of a shadow and terrified of going to jail and so worried about going to jail that he's making mistakes that could end up getting him and the papers caught. And so according to Sheehan, he's lying to his source, breaking a promise that he's going to not copy the papers, and copying them, because of the overriding importance of getting the papers out. Now, the reason I say this is not true is because, later on in the story, the story goes on to say that Ellsberg would only give the papers to Sheehan if Sheehan assured him that the New York Times was interested in publishing them, because this was Ellsberg's, big preoccupation was that these papers he had gotten out at great risk to himself, he wanted to get them published. And so, he was very interested in getting assurance from Sheehan that was in fact going to happen. And for reasons that are not very clear in the story, in Sheehan's version of events, Sheehan doesn't tell him that the Times is in fact very interested in publishing the Pentagon Papers. They start this big project. They bring together top editors and reporters and feverishly work to publish the version that Sheehan had secretly copied. And he doesn't tell this to Ellsberg. And Ellsberg is because he is desperate to get these things published. He's talking to other possible outlets that might give the papers an airing.
Well, he even eventually gave them to Senator Mike Gravel. Yeah.
Yeah. It really, like, this is, Sheehan's, the suggestion that Sheehan has that he's not telling Ellsberg that the Times is working on publishing because he thinks it's somehow going to be insecure. It's completely backwards, because it's actually putting the papers in much more jeopardy by not telling Ellsberg. So Ellsberg is going around looking for another outlet, and every time you tell someone about a secret, you're exposing the risk of exposure.
Well, couldn't Sheehan have hurt Ellsberg in a way too? I mean, couldn't he have blown Ellsberg's cover in this way?
Yeah. I mean, Ellsberg was at huge risk. I think at the time, the legal terrain has shifted somewhat. It's not clear that at the time that anyone would have contemplated prosecuting the New York Times or Neil Sheehan for publishing these secrets, but Ellsberg very much was in legal jeopardy for having taken classified information out of the Pentagon and made copies of it. That was clearly against the law. He did, in fact, face indictment later on, but the reason that the story that the New York Times tells is not true is that eventually Sheehan asked Ellsberg again for a copy of the papers, even though he already had the copy of the papers, and at that point Ellsberg said sure. Maybe thinking that this would encourage them to publish if they had a copy of it. So even though the Times clearly says Mr. Ellsberg never gave the papers to the Times, if you keep reading, it's like
38 paragraphs later, I believe.
Yeah, 38 paragraphs later, you find out he did give them to the New York Times. And so the ruse that Sheehan carries out is completely unnecessary. He just lied to the source, betrayed this confidence for no reason. And that's, I think, why this story is framed in this, inaccurate way, is because without the inaccuracy, you have a story that makes Sheehan look pretty terrible. And I think it's a, I think of Sheehan as one of the good guys. He did important work in revealing the nightmares of the Vietnam War. But this, this sort of final act is kind of, he's behaving dishonestly and recklessly in ways that put a key whistleblower at risk, and then tells the story in a way to make him the hero, to aggrandize himself at the expense of the person who really is one of the great heroes of American history, Daniel Ellsberg.
If we could, just two more things here. When the papers are published and Ellsberg discovers the ruse, Sheehan has Ellsberg saying, "So you stole it like I did," to which Sheehan supposedly replied, "This is straight from the article, everyone. No, Dan, I didn't steal it, and neither did you. Those papers are the property of the people of the United States. They paid for them with their national treasure and the blood of their sons, and they have a right to it." And I don't want to speculate here, but there's something about that line of dialogue that feels very, I don't know, like out of an action movie, maybe a sequel to Red Dawn. There's just something odd about it.
Yeah, it sure sounds like what you wish you had said rather than what you actually said. We weren't in the room, so we don't know what was actually said, but it does not have what you'd call the ring of truth to it.
The other thing I wanted to cover briefly here is Daniel Ellsberg is actually still alive.
Yeah.
Was he consulted for this story at all or no?
He was not. There's a brief reference to his book where he tells his version of events. But the reporter does not give Ellsberg a call and ask him, the only other surviving witness to most of this story, what he thinks happened, what he remembers happening, which I think is sort of strange for a New York Times journalist to operate. But again, it's unless you have Ellsberg as this kind of hapless neurotic that is putting the papers at risk with his bumbling, then you do not have a story that paints Sheehan in a favorable light at all. So I think that you avoid talking to Ellsberg because there's a good chance that he's going to ruin your story. It's too good to check, as they say.
And I think Daniel Ellsberg also took issue with the – I guess his side of the story is he did not say, "So you stole it like I did." He said, "You did what I did." And also,
right.
How does Daniel Ellsberg's son, Robert Ellsberg, figure into Fair's coverage of this?
Well, Robert wrote a lengthy response on Twitter to the story, not nearly as lengthy as the story itself, but for in Twitter terms, it's pretty long. Where he, he knows the story very well. This is kind of the family history, and to him, the idea that his father needed to be lectured on, who owns government information, was ludicrous. As was the idea that Ellsberg, Daniel Ellsberg, was quaking in fear of being arrested and going to jail. And in fact, when Ellsberg was arraigned. You know, he was eventually arrested and for exposing these secrets, and was asked, you know, aren't you afraid of going to prison by reporters? He said, would not you go to prison to help end this war? You know, that was his attitude. But you know, it's got to, this character has to be, he's got to be made less of a hero in order to make Sheehan into more of a hero. Because otherwise, Sheehan is just a reporter who's like messing with a source in a way that's really like, you know, you don't steal notes from a source. That's not like how journalists typically operate. But apparently, that's the way Sheehan operated.
And everyone can read about Daniel Ellsberg's telling of the events in his memoir. I believe it's called Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers.
Right.
Is there anything else you would like to add in regards to maybe explaining to my audience, or maybe younger members of my audience that don't know as much about the Pentagon Papers, they may have learned about it in school. Why is this story so important? Why was there an action alert about it? Why do you think we need to shed light on this and maybe even contact the New York Times? You know, we can always send letters.
Well, I think that the attitude that is reflected in this story, that journalists are the real heroes and that whistleblowers are kind of, you know, weirdo misfits that you don't need to treat with much respect, is still very much alive today.
I was going to say that that's become sort of a common theme for some journalism dealing with whistleblowers, that whistleblowers are unreliable or a bit out there. It seems like that's been a recurring narrative for some journalism dealing with whistleblowers, and that's a dangerous path we're on.
And you know, the biggest whistleblowers of the modern era, you know, Edward Snowden is in exile. Chelsea Manning was imprisoned and kept in solitary confinement for long periods of time, jeopardizing her mental health. Julian Assange has been imprisoned. The United States is trying to extradite him. He's been kept in solitary, which, you know, the just as a side note, these people are kept in solitary confinement under the pretense that, like, they might have, like, one last secret that they have kept squirreled away, you know, in their head. And if you allow them to meet with other people, they might blurt out that last secret. And, you know, and so you keep them in solitary confinement, which we know is a form of psychological torture. You know, people are social animals, and to keep them isolated from their fellow humans is really a brutal thing to do to people. And has devastating consequences for their psyches. So this is what the whistleblowers, the Daniel Ellsbergs of the 21st century are going through. And without a lot of sympathy from the Times, you know, the Times which published, you know, Manning's revelations via Assange, you know, and got Pulitzers for doing this work. You know, treated as, you know, heroes of the profession. But when, you know, Assange is in the dock in London being, you know, they're trying to force him to be sent to the United States so they can be tried for espionage for revealing U.S. war crimes, the Times is doing virtually nothing to help him, like saying almost nothing about this case. Because he's just a whistleblower. He's not a you know, heroic journalist. I think that is the Times attitude, and that's why we wrote this action alert and why people want people to ask the Times to set this record straight on a matter that is, you know, quite clearly wrong by the evidence of their own reporting.
Do you think also that, you know, when a report like this comes out from the New York Times and, you know, there's no interview given to Daniel Ellsberg, no really, you know, he's not approached for his response or his side of it. In an age where people are rightly concerned about fake news and, you know, there's a growing distrust of media outlets, this can come back to haunt outlets like the New York Times. It erodes trust, I think, in our cherished media outlets.
Yeah, I think that is an odd part of the story because, you know, when you think of the New York Times self-proclaimed code of ethics, the idea that you get both sides is what they pride themselves on. And, you know, you see, it's very common to see, you know, so-and-so declined comment or whatever in an article to show that they did, in fact, try to get the other side of whatever story that they're working on. The fact that they did not make any attempt to get that side in the story. There's a follow-up where the New York Times ran a story about the story where another journalist interviewed Jenny Scott about how she got this story because, you know, she's a hero too because she revealed the secret heroism of Neil Sheehan, which makes her a hero one step removed. But that didn't talk to Ellsberg. You know, they're writing up the write-up, and, you know, still the person who is really the most important figure in the story still doesn't get to speak in the New York Times version. I was also struck in the Jenny Scott piece. It's very long, and online it's got there's a picture of Neil Sheehan, and there's a picture of A.M. Rosenthal, who's the managing editor at the time of the New York Times, huddling with Sheehan and other reporters working on the papers. And then there's a story, a picture of A.M. Rosenthal with the published edition of the paper, you know, congratulating reporters on the great work they did. And I thought that was so, like, revealing. Like, this is a story about the Times and what a great job they did. And erasing the actual person who put his liberty at risk and his life at risk, because there was talk inside the Nixon administration of assassinating him. For him to just vanish, so that there could be another picture of Times journalists literally patting themselves on the back. I think it's just a picture is worth a thousand words, as they say.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. I feel like it brings up the question of, you know, what is the duty of a journalist? Are we here to make ourselves seem like the big heroes, or are we here to, you know, report? And I think there are brave journalists, of course, but is it about doing our job or sort of patting ourselves on the back? And I think it should be. It's our job to report on these stories.
Yeah, the Times, you know, the Times reporters traditionally didn't refer to themselves in the first person. You know, if they come up in a story, they generally, you know, say a reporter did something, and not mention that the reporter was themselves. The idea of turning themselves into this, you know, as you say, sort of an action movie hero at the expense of the person who is actually, you know, whose story you're ostensibly telling, It is kind of grotesque.
In conclusion, how can my listeners push back on things like this happening in our media institutions? I know there's writing letters. How would you suggest that people who are interested in taking action do that?
Well, it is something that we try to add when we report on some particular news outlet doing something that we think is problematic. We try to include contact information at the end of the article to have an email address and often a Twitter handle for the outlet or for the reporters involved. And I think social media actually can be pretty effective. It's a more public way of sending a message than writing an email, and therefore more likely to get their attention, I think. And I think that there are real possibilities for making a critique in a more or less public forum like Twitter, and kind of forcing journalists, corporate media journalists, to pay attention.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, or if you'd like, you can let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work and the work of FAIR?
Well, the website is just fair.org, F-A-I-R. And you can sign up for our email list there, and you can get all of our posts delivered to your email box. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. For people who I assume, like many of your listeners, like to hear their news rather than read it, we have a radio show called Counterspin that is on about 130 stations across the country.
It's an excellent program, and I highly recommend Counterspin, actually, so I'm glad you mentioned that. Well, thank you again, Jim, for coming on Parallax News.
Thanks for having me on. It's good to talk about this.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax News. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jim Nerikas of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a very influential and important media watchdog organization doing fine work that I hope you will consider keeping up with. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax J.G. Michael. Views to Parallax with J.G. Parallax Michael. Views with Parallax J.G. Michael.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff It's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.